Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. I have Eugene McCarthy back for another episode, and today we're going to delve into a specific hybrid speciation hypothesis, which has utterly grabbed my attention, and is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Eugene, because it's such a remarkable story. And Eugene, can you tell us how you came to start this process of this particular hypothesis, and then we can build up through the details and your recent paper, which has laid a whole extra level of evidence on top of this amazing hypothesis.
Well, I'll do what I can, Shane. And I find that this is best explained in a chronological order, or at least chronological with respect to how I came to investigate it and think about it. And if I was going to go back to the earliest point at which I began to go down the road towards investigating this, it would be all the way back to the fourth grade when I read a book about the discovery of Lascaux Cave and the cave paintings there in France. And that got me thinking as a child about prehistory of humans. And I was curious about where humans came from. And I read a lot of books about that when I was a kid. But then later on, when I was in my 20s, I read The Origin of Species, and there was a chapter in there that struck me because it had a lot of information in it that didn't jive with what I had thought about hybrids. Darwin talks about hybrids in there in connection with trying to show that God must not be running the show with evolution, because the phenomenon of hybridization is so haphazardous with respect to how many of the crosses are fertile and how many of the hybrids are viable. Whereas if hybrid sterility were set up to keep the different kinds of organisms apart, you would think if God was running a show that they would all be sterile and they would all be inviable. But he gave all these examples of hybrids that were fertile, about as fertile as non-hybrids, and they're viable. And so that got me to thinking about hybridization, and I was curious about it, so I started reading reports about hybridization, and I found that he was right, that there are a lot of hybrids that can produce offspring, and that they do occur in nature, and that they seem to be perfectly viable, in some cases more viable than their parents. And so my reading verified what he said. And so I also, while I was reading about hybrids, encountered reports where they had found some identified organism out in a natural setting, and they set about trying to figure out what it might be. And when they hypothesized that it might be a hybrid, they would look to see what other type of animal it was similar to, and then they would take that animal that was that it did resemble, say animal A, and they would take a list of traits in their unknown organism that were not present in organism A, and they took that as a list of traits that would describe the other parent if this organism was a hybrid. In other words, the assumption would be that if it was a hybrid, that it would be combining traits of two other organisms, and likely one of those organisms would be the organism that it was most similar to, organism A, and then their list of traits that distinguished it from A would describe some second organism B that was the other parent in the cross that produced it. And so with all of my interest in human origins going back into childhood, wasn't long before I thought of the idea of just kind of a lark to see whether you could do something similar with humans, whether you could take a comparison of humans with what are considered to be their closest living relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, get a list of traits that distinguish humans from chimpanzees and bonobos, and see whether that list describes some second organism. And so that point, I didn't really have much hope that it would work out, and or that it would even be a good theory. But I set about reading papers, so they're saying, well, these are the amazing human traits that set us apart, or and I start compiling a list, and then I started looking up where these traits might be found in other kinds of animals, and I pretty soon figured out that most of those traits, probably about 90%, the ones that set us apart from chimpanzees and bonobos, are not found in other primates. And so at that point, I cast my net wider and just looked for any organism that might have all those traits. And as it, well, I'll mention some of the traits before I
Yeah, that'd be a
reveal
good place to
the
start.
mystery organism.
Yeah, that'd
But
be a
there are
good
things
place to
like,
start because there's a lot of them that when you ha when they're pointed out to you, when you can, and particularly the visible ones, when you look at a chimpanzee and you look at a human, there's a few really odd features in humans that don't appear in other primates, and I think we've kind of got used to not paying attention to them.
well, I mean, one that's pretty obvious is, the visible white of the eye around the irises that we have. You don't see that in other primates. Another is you can move the skin around in your face voluntarily and in your neck as well, but not in other parts of the body. Other primates can move the skin around all over their body in the same way that we can move our face and neck skin around. They have muscles in their skins, and the vasculature in the skin runs parallel to the surface in other primates, whereas in ours, it rises up from below like little trees, and there's also like a much something like 100 times the circulation of blood goes from our deep muscle up into the skin. About 100 times as much circulation goes there as does in other primates. And that may be why, it may have something to do with why we're subject to mosquitoes and fleas where they are not, because there's a lot of blood there for them to dine on. Another one of these traits that sets us apart is multipyramidal kidneys. So we have, well, we describe it as kidney-shaped kidneys. So they're, in other words, other primates or chimpanzees. I don't know the anatomy, specific anatomy of every different primate, but in chimpanzees and bonobos, they have a triangular-shaped kidney. Ours is, like I say, what we describe as kidney shape, where it's kind of looks like an oval that's bent to the side at each end. And if you look inside a bonobo or chimpanzee, or you can refer to those two as pannans because they're of the genus Pan. But pannans have a single pyramid inside the kidney where we have usually about 10. And if you look out, another trait is if you look under the tips of the skin on the tips of our fingers and toes, you'll find little hoof-shaped processes. They're called ungual tuberosities. Those are not present in other primates. Another characteristic is our cartilaginous nose. That's also a very weird trait that's not typical of primates.
And there's no very good theories about why humans would have evolved our pointy noses gradually from chimpanzees that have,
Well, I
you know,
mean,
pretty
you
much
can
no
say,
nose.
though, that there are, like, I see things that I guess you'd say ad hoc theories that are intended to explain that specific trait. They'll advance some sort of selectionist argument, but then you have to advance a separate argument for each one of those things. Whereas what I found was that one organism will account for all those traits. If you go through the analysis of the various anatomical features, you can find one animal that has all those traits. I'll mention one more before I reveal the mystery animal, which probably quite a few people already know what I'm going to say. But another trait that I consider major is the presence of vocal cords. We have these tough, yellow, ligamentous vocal cords that allow us to, have a voice. Those are not present in chimpanzees, bonobos. They have little ridges inside their larynxes that are not, they have no ability to tighten and loosen on a voluntary basis. So I've seen them called vocal folds or vocal cords, but they're not vocal cords like we have. They are just, it's kind of like a couple of ridges on the inside of the larynx that are in about the same place as we have our vocal cords, but they have no such structure. Whereas the mystery animal, which I'm about to reveal, has two sets of vocal cords, very similar to ours, yellow ligamentous, and they can be used at very high volume, so such large volume that it's almost deafening. But that mystery animal that turned out to have all these characteristics was pig,
The humble pig.
given the scientific name of Sus scrofa or Sus domesticus, something similar to a domestic pig fits the bill. So when you use that animal, or not use it, when you examine that, the traits of that animal, it has virtually every trait that sets us apart from chimpanzees and bonobos. So,
It's worth pointing out too that this list of traits unusual in pigs compared to like most other mammals as well. Like pigs are quite strange in their.
It seems, Shane, for example, the multipyramidal kidneys that, I mean, if you take a pig kidney and look at it and compare it to a human kidney, you would have a little trouble telling which was which, which, you have trouble telling them apart. Whereas it'd be very obvious if you took a chimpanzee kidney and set it down beside, because you'd have this triangular thing that was different outside and inside from a pig or a human kidney. So there are all these traits that relate to the skin and various internal traits of internal organs. There are lots of features of our bones that set us apart from primates. And so all these traits, I don't know the exact number, but it's around 100 different traits that I compiled. And it's like just check, check, check. They virtually all check off. And to the extent that the small extent that they don't check off, I think that you'd expect that, because if you're talking about an ancient event where a pig mated with a, say, a bonobo and produced early humans, you would expect that ancient pig to be somewhat different from the modern domestic pig, to some degree, and might have a few traits that are not present in the modern domestic pig. So
Do we
few
have a
traits of,
rough
a few traits, like for example, I've been a little puzzled about the human eyebrows, because pigs don't have, at least most domestic pigs I've looked at don't seem to have prominent eyebrows. But that may be just because particular pigs that I've looked at don't match the ones that participated in this anciently. And there also are a lot of different pigs even today around the world. There are ones in Southeast Asia that have big beards and lots of hair on their face. And so it's difficult to say whether, pigs, they might exist still at this time with that particular trait. But as I say, it's like nearly all of the traits, with a couple of major exceptions that have to be gone into separately, clearly match this hypothesis or this theory. Whereas if you start to try to explain all these traits in terms of Darwinian theory or in terms of natural selection, divergence, and isolation, that sort of outlook, then you have to come up with something that's advantageous about each of these traits that caused us to develop them under the influence of natural selection. And in that case, you have a lot of separate ad hoc arguments that have to be made up to explain what you're observing, whereas this explains nearly everything with one simple assumption. So that's a big strength of this theory. And
Is there any punctuate?
I'm not going to try to go into all the different traits, but I list them all on my website. And so
I'd
People
recommend people to check out macroevolution.net to see the full rundown. It is, when you see it all in one place, it's very difficult to just hand wave it away. There's a lot all pointing in the same direction.
And just to a certain extent, it's, I don't know, I guess it's theoretically a nice thing. It's nice to have something that explains the whole spectrum facts instead of trying to sit. And I mean, a lot of times when you're reading about human evolution, they are focused on some particular trait and they say, well, why did this occur? And they're, oh, it's because they're out on the savannah and they're hunting and they had to have thumbs to throw their spears. And so I don't know, they just come up with these little just so stories for each
Yep.
different thing.
And
And
if all that fails, then
theoretical
you've always
standpoint,
got
that's just kind of
sexual.
messy.
If all that
What?
fails, you've got sexual selection that, you know, they suddenly
Yeah, it's,
found it attractive.
I mean, it's almost, you could say that, if you're imaginative, you can always come up with some little story to explain any particular trait you're talking about. But if each explanation is different, that subtracts from the power of the explanation. If this one explanation explains all, I believe the term for that is consilience. If you have consilience in a theory, it makes it much more powerful and desirable to have that theory than the one that you have to like. Well, I mean, I think of the old pre-Copernican explanations of planetary movements. They would make up, all these little sub-theories to explain the odd movements of the planets, where once Copernicus came along, it was all explained by one sort of viewpoint.
Yeah. Is there any evidence of a punctuated equilibrium in the fossil record for humans? Like we're used to seeing that ascent of man with the very gradual becoming upright between the forms, but is that, I mean, the reconstruction of the posture of an organism from its fossil involves a bit of guesswork. Do you have a sense there might be a break point where things seem to happen more suddenly?
Well, the
And I guess it's
earliest
tricky
humans,
because
if you go back, like,
a lot of the soft tissue evidence that you've compiled, we don't necessarily have direct indications from the fossil
well, all
record.
the bony traits that we have that set us apart from tannins are present in the earliest hominins. Tannins are bow-legged, where we're knock-kneed. We have more lumbar vertebrae than they do. Their pelvis is long and heavy, ours is short. The traits that the early hominins had, which we also have, set us apart, allow us to bend our body backwards to get it above the center of gravity. And that's a lot of that's to do with the larger number of lumbar vertebrae. I can say as an aside that I found from my doctor recently that I have one more lumbar vertebrum than other humans. I've
Interesting
been extra long.
variation.
And so I guess I'm even more flexible in that region than other humans. I can stand even more erect, but I was surprised to find that out. But the thing is that all those traits are early, they're early on, and the early hominins also have the ungual tuberosities, the hoof-shaped processes on the tips of their fingers and toes, where tannins do not. And there's just one trait after another that is present in the skeletal anatomy that they have from the get-go. So it may be that they looked physically different, but their skeletons had those traits. And
And all
so
of those traits appeared
it's
pretty much at the same time. All those traits appeared at the same time. Like there's no transitional fossils that have some of the pig-like
well,
traits, but
yeah,
not others.
it does look like that if you're looking back. When they're identifying them as hominins, of course, they're doing that on the basis of skeletal traits. And
Yeah.
this, they say, well, these are the skeletal traits that they have, and these are hominins.
Yeah.
And so when they list those traits, they list the kind of traits that set us apart from tannins. So it's pretty much perfect overlap between the two categories. You can't be the bony remains of a ancient hominin and not have those traits because those are the traits that set us apart from simians.
Do you
And
have a
I
rough
said,
idea
well, I
about
didn't say
when?
that's the case, but
Do
that's
you?
what
Oh, sorry, I
that's
was just
fun to
asking if you have an idea about when that hybridization event likely happened.
Well, before we go on to that, let me point out that that's one of the two traits that pigs don't have. Major traits is bipedality, upright walking. But the way that's explained under the theory is that a combination of traits allowed upright walking in hominins, where a chimpanzee has trouble standing erect because there's very little flexibility between the pelvis and the ribs because there are fewer lumbar vertebrae there, and so the ribs come down and nearly touch the pelvis, whereas in humans there's a wide gap. And the same thing is the case with pigs. So pigs have lots of lumbar vertebrae, and they also have all these other features that are associated with and are used to explain bipedality in humans.
I remember
So
seeing
usually, if they
that.
put them in to add them to ape anatomy, you get something that's bipedal. So it's not that pigs have to be bipedal, it's that they have traits that are added to something else to give you a bipedal animal. So that's all you want to say about that.
Oh, yeah, I remember reading as well with pigs, their hind limbs are longer than their forelimbs, like humans, but monkeys, it's simians, it's the other way around. Their arms are much longer than their legs usually.
Another feature is that assists us in standing upright is the gluteus maximus is very large and stabilizing. And also, I kind of laugh, but it's pigs are well known for their large hams, and so they do have large muscles in that region. But what was the question you asked a moment ago? I'm sorry.
Oh, just about
I'm not doing so.
the relative limb length. Oh, and how long ago do you think the hybridization event probably
Well, that's the
happened?
thing about hybridization. It's often the case when people are talking about origins, they think of one origin occurring. And it could be, since with hybridization, in many cases, there are a lot of hybrid zones around. A hybrid zone is a geographic region where two different types of organisms come into contact and produce hybrids on an ongoing basis. It could be, there's nothing to exclude the possibility that hybridization of this kind happened repeatedly. It seems from looking at the ethological characteristics of Tannins and pigs, that the psychological makeup or whatever the behavioral tendencies of those animals would be compatible with a female bonobo presenting her genitals to a pig. That's the usual response that a bonobo or a chimpanzee has when it's being attacked by it crouches down and presents its genitals. And pigs are well known to be extremely indiscriminate in what other organism they'll choose to mount and have sex with. They'll even have sex with a plastic tube on a sawhorse. They don't mind as long as they can introduce themselves into a suitable cylinder. I guess you'd say they're not particular in that respect. So
And they're both forest creatures too, so
what?
they're both they're forest creatures, yeah.
They would encounter each other in at least in regions where their geographic ranges overlapped, which interestingly would be the Upper Nile Valley, which I've often thought, I don't know, there's no direct evidence, but I've often thought, well, earliest civilizations rose in that area where they came into contact. But to answer your question more fully, it could be that that continued happening now and then, or possibly frequently, I don't know, over a long period of time. And it's even conceivable that it's still happening. But there's not, that's something that's not been investigated. So you can just say that there's nothing to say that it did happen at a particular time. Of course, it had to happen for the first time at some point. And at that point, you would have a heterogeneous population of hybrids that some of which would be more viable than others, some more intelligent than others, and some more fertile than others. And things would sort out from there under the influence of selection among those individuals. But it wouldn't be the sort of ongoing selection that's talked about in Darwinian gradual divergence, because it would be happening most rapidly right after the crossing occurred, when the level of variation was the highest, and then would decline over time as the level of variation declined. So, whereas with Darwinian theory, it's pictured as fairly uniform rate of mutation over time, and favorable mutations go to fixation within the population. They spread in the population and go to a level of 100%, the influence of natural selection. But there's no particular time when there's more selection going on than at others. So that's one thing that's different about hybrid genesis, is that you have selection concentrated into particular periods. But one thing I think I should probably get into to a certain extent is that one of the big objections, perhaps the biggest objection to this theory, is that pigs and chimpanzees are very different. They belong to different taxonomic orders. Chimpanzees belong to the order Primates, and pigs belong to Artiodactyla, which is even-toed ungulates, even-toed hooved animals. And so,
And they were meant to have
well, people say, well,
diverged tens of millions of years ago. I think tens of millions of years is how long ago they diverged from each other, according to standard models.
A lot of that, those estimates, those time estimates, Shane, depend on the acceptance of a lack of hybridization going on, where they only work for trees that are strictly divergent and not reconnecting by hybridization. But yeah, that's what they talk about. It's like a long time ago, much longer ago than humans to chimpanzees, to get back to where apes and pigs. I mean, apes and pigs, by conventional estimates, be 60, 70 million years ago, a long time back.
It's
But
around
anyway,
about the
my
time the
point is
dinosaurs died out.
that I'm not.
It's around about the time that the dinosaurs died out.
The idea is that reptiles were controlling the Earth during the Mesozoic, and then mammals came on during the present period, Cenozoic. But the thing I'm trying to get to a minute ago was that, in response to this objection, which I thought was pretty valid, I started to look around for cases, reports about animals that were hybrids that had been produced from more distant crosses, a similar distance to what you have with a pannon and a pig. And I already, before I started really trying to compile such reports in earnest, I had written a book on bird hybrids, which was published by Oxford University Press. It's like, well, a book that's worldwide in scope, that covers, at least attempts to cover, all reported bird hybrids of all kinds. And so in compiling that and writing that up, I went through about 5,000 different reports about hybrids, books, papers, and videos, and photographs. And among those reports, I encountered a lot about bird hybrids that were about equally as distant as our pannons and pigs. One that I encountered repeatedly is duck and chicken. Those are members of distinct avian orders, Anseriformes and Galliformes. And they are quite a lot of reports describing such animals. And so I found that as I was looking at these reports, that I just didn't take them too seriously. But as I looked at more and more of them, and looked at more and more different categories of more and more different types of crosses that I began to take them more seriously. Another one that's actually very commonly reported, I've since collected perhaps about 100 reports, is the cat and rabbit. Those, if you ask me, or if you didn't ask me, say 10 years ago, I would have said it was impossible. But during that time period, collecting all these reports for my book on distant hybrids, which I titled Telenothians, I came to realize that these animals almost certainly do exist, and that they even have a typical appearance. The front half of about the navel forward is very cat-like, although the front legs are usually kind of curved and deformed, but they look just like a cat. Apparently, they don't meow, but otherwise, they look like a cat. But the rear end looks exactly like a rabbit with a little tufty tail and the rabbit legs. And the front claws are cat-like, and the back claws are rabbit-like. And they move with a hopping motion like a rabbit. They will eat things like carrots and lettuce, but also they will eat meat. And so that to my mind is just as different and odd as a pig and a chimpanzee. And there are many, many other equally distant combinations that I cover in my book, Telenothians. And another one that I could mention right away is there's a long history of cattle horse composites known as Jumarts. They have characteristics of both cattle and horses, and they're produced not always, but usually by a bull mounting a horse. And the horse later gives birth to an offspring that has mixed characteristics. And I put that section of the book up on ResearchGate, so it's publicly available if anybody wants to look at it there. But that's just one category. There are many other such very distant hybrids. So what that all boils down to is that the objection that people used to raise, that I took myself took pretty seriously, that pigs and pandas are too different for this to occur, I don't take that seriously anymore. I think that the actual case is that you have to, even if a cross seems distant to you have to actually try it out to know whether it might work or not. There's not, you can't just look at two animals or two plants and say, well, these are too distant to mate. There's no hard and fast rule that's going to tell you whether they can produce offspring or not together.
And it's a difficult phenomenon to study in a lab because presumably the more distant creatures are, the more likely they are to have a low probability of producing a viable offspring. So you
Well,
may need to
I
do a
guess so, but I
thousand
mean,
or a million matings to have a reasonable chance of getting at least one.
possibly, but you have to keep in mind, though, Shane, that that's not, you're not talking about the results of a scientific study there when you say that. You're talking about something that's a long-standing attitude that goes back for centuries, and it's just something that people have long assumed. And it's associated with that. I shouldn't say that. I haven't mentioned it yet, but there was this idea back during the early scientific era. There was already this idea that there was a natural order set up by God that kept every different type of organism separate. And the people that looked on things that way more willingly accepted the idea of similar organisms producing offspring and more distant ones, that was more anathema to that sort of worldview. And that pretty much unexamined was accepted into early scientific thought and continues to this day. But as far as actually seeing any study where someone has randomly selected pairings and attempted to produce offspring from those pairings and then rated them in terms of frequency of fertilization, plotted that against taxonomic distance. I haven't seen a single such study. And the ones where it actually does seem to bear on the experiments that seem to bear on that sort of question, they got results that were surprising to me at the time I read them. There was a guy back, he was working a little over 100 years ago at the University of Chicago, H.H. Newman. He took milt from various kinds of fishes and used them to use the milt to fertilize a wide variety of egg masses. And he found that you could produce hybrids between fish in separate orders, separate super orders. A lot of them came out inviable and very weird looking, but you could, in many cases, see with minnows that were viable and seemed to be swimming around and doing fine, before you dispose of them. But, a lot of the hybrids that he produced had very weird characteristics, like hearts outside their body, and very, well, I remember him saying that some of them had like eyes on the end of stalks. And so there was a very high level of variation, and a lot of the variation, some of the individuals would be, I mean, many of the individuals would not be functional and would die soon, very soon after conception or whatever. And
I
there were
believe
others that survived much longer.
something similar was recently reproduced crossing sturgeons and paddlefish,
Yeah, that
which
was just a serendipitous thing, though. That's the thing, is a lot of the stuff that happens is just serendipitous. They don't systematically try like H.H. Newman did. They just say, "Hey, wow, this is amazing. We didn't expect this to happen," and write a paper about it, and then they move on to whatever they were doing before. There was a, I mean, I remember in the Copenhagen Zoo, they put babirusas and pigs together in an enclosure, and they unexpectedly got hybrids. And they said, "Wow, this is, we thought this wasn't possible." And they reported it, but they didn't. It's not like on that basis anyone went about doing random fertilizations with pig semen in a wide variety of animals. They didn't do that. They just reported their surprising result. So I think it's the, well, I think part of it is that there's a ancient bias against hybrids that, I mean, you see it in all sorts of negative connotations that you have, like, there's thoroughbred versus hybrid, versus half breed or mongrel versus pure. They're in a lot of people's minds. I mean, I see it even in my children, like they never want their, things mixed on their plate. They want to keep their, vegetables away from their meat. They didn't want to have anything mixed up. It's like there's this very basic, almost primordial, I'd almost say, I would almost describe it as primordial prejudice against mixing. It's you hear like words like tainted. Tainted has a negative sense, whereas, just mixed doesn't really have that connotation. But I think that there is that. It might not be so ancient. It might be, I think it might possibly be associated with the Christian worldview, in which there's a God keeping things ordered. It may be that it's, at least in part, arises out of that worldview. But then that worldview may arise out of this thing where children don't like mixing. It may be
I
that.
believe the idea of cleanliness and purity was originally a spiritual or a religious kind of concept before it became, associated with germs and disease.
Yeah, it's hard to trace it all back, but there is definitely something there, something that people have trouble. Like, I remember the cases in my book, Telenotheion. A friend of my wife's was looking at it, and she's saying, "Oh, I can't look at that." Was her response. "I just can't look at that." And I thought, well, And how will you learn about that? If you can't look at it, you will not learn about it. You'll just continue thinking as you always have thought, and you'll continue thinking incorrectly about whether these things are possible or not.
On the flip side to that, you also have a really ancient tradition of organisms that are half and half, often like anthropomorphized human kind of animals. Like think of the Egyptian gods that were humans with animal heads. And that's kind of trickled through into like fairy tales. So I wonder if that's another thing that counts against this theory, that it seems almost fanciful or magical because of that cultural connection.
Yeah, well, I mean, if or it could be that the Egyptians knew something that we've forgotten. It could be that they knew about composites that are possible that we now imagine to be impossible, but imagine incorrectly. It's hard to say, but I do think that a lot of that. This idea that such things are impossible is something that people take it at, they accept it at a gut level almost, where they just instantly say, well, this is impossible. And they never get past that because they've been perhaps told all their lives, or I don't know if they've even been told, because it's not something that people talk about all the time, but must be that it is picked up fairly early on. I mean, there are lots of things we do with body language that we're never aware of where we pick them up, but it's part of the culture. There are.
I noticed in Telanothians, your book cataloguing wide animal hybrids, a lot of the reports are from the 1800s and before. And I wonder if the industrialization of farming and separating all of the species and controlling all of the matings has potentially reduced the incidence of these of the opportunities for these wide crosses.
Possibly. I mean, it's I think it's definitely the case with the cow horse composites that I mentioned earlier, the Jumarts. That used to be there was open range and pretty free mixture of cattle with horses back in the day, where with the advent of especially of barbed wire to separate out different pastures, different things, allowing the animals to be kept separately, a lot of that sexual contact no longer became possible. But there are others that I guess have continued to occur. I mean, people still keep cats and rabbits together, and they continue to occur. And there are videos. I've got a lot of videos of such animals on my website. And so it depends on the cross. It's almost like there's certain crosses fall out of fashion or just stop happening for various things, for various reasons, just because conditions have changed for whatever reason. Or, if you have an animal that comes in to a new region, such as when the mallard came into New Zealand back in the 1800s, it was brought to New Zealand, it started hybridizing with the Pacific black duck, which it previously scarcely came in contact with. And now you can scarcely find any purebred mallards or Pacific black ducks in New Zealand. They're mostly just hybrids of one kind or another. So that's something that came to be because of new conditions. Then, you can have other things, like I was saying with Jumart, where horses and cattle are not kept together very much anymore. Although there are a few much more recent reports about such animals. And then there are other ones that seem to just keep on going and going. The very most common cross in Telanothians, I've got it all, got a chronology for each different cross, and I mean, for each different reported event since, back Roman times to the present, and the current edition that's about to come out, and enumerated, counted all the different types of crosses. And the very most common cross, there are 3,000 reported events or births, approximately 3,000 in the book now, and 300 of those are pig humans. That's the most common thing, and most of those are the offspring of pigs, although there's a good percentage of those that are the offspring of women. And so I think that also bears on the fact that, not the fact, but bears on the theory of pigs crossing with apes to produce humans, because why is that? 10% of the reported wide crosses in that book, all the, or at least 99% of the crosses listed in that book are interordinal. And among those interordinal crosses, 10% are human with pig. And many of those have occurred here in the United States, many there in Australia, going back and centuries back in England and Germany, Italy. There are these reports about animals that have, well, for the most part, the ones that are born from sows have human-like faces, and often like entire human heads. Why would that be the most common one if the pigs had nothing to do with us?
Yeah. It's interesting. When I first heard about this theory, I suddenly had empathy for the people who'd grown up in a creationist Christian mindset worldview when they were confronted with the idea that humans might actually be descended from chimpanzees. And there was an expression of revulsion and rejection and kind of horror at that idea. And to take it another step and move on to the pig chimp hybrid hypothesis. I think a lot of people today, with their modern Darwinist, of course we're descended from chimpanzees, it's obvious. I think they probably have a similar gut reaction to being a little bit disoriented and overwhelmed
Yeah,
and
it's a bit
shocked.
ironic in a way. It's a bit ironic in a way because they were the same people who kind of poo-pooed the attitude of creationists. Don't know. I guess I feel about it the same way that Stephen Gould described punctuated equilibrium to me once. I had a conversation with him years ago, and I was saying that geneticists would not accept punctuated equilibrium because he gave no explanation of why this pattern is seen in the fossil record. And he said, well, they have to accept it because it's a fact, it's an unobserved fact. And whether you have an explanation or not, it's an observed fact. And so a lot of this information that relates to the theory that I'm talking about, these are observed facts. These are things that you have to accept if you want to be scientific. Of course, you don't have to be scientific. You can just say, well, I'm just going to ignore this and I'm not going to take it into account. But if you really want to be scientific, you have to accept these facts that relate to the theory, at least. You have to say, well, yes, it's true that we have multi-pyramidal kidneys and that chimpanzees do not. We have to accept that we have musculature in our skin, of our face and our neck, and that pigs have that same pattern. They have, I didn't mention that earlier, but they have musculature similar to ours in their skin. They control movement of their skin in their face and in their neck, but not elsewhere, just as is the case with us. And so even if you don't accept the theory, you have to accept these anatomical facts. And that might be a good transition to talking about my recent paper.
Oh, yes. So the obvious other objection is, well, there should be genetic evidence. We should be able to look at
Yeah,
the
and I struggled with
genomes.
that for years. I became a geneticist early on because I was interested in the question of, finding genetic evidence for this anatomically based theory that I had. And I said, well, that was my attitude that, people said that there should be some genetic evidence, and that was my attitude too. And so when I, anatomical evidence is fairly easy to understand without a lot of technological background. And so I just initially, I didn't really understand genetics at all. And so I didn't see whether there was evidence or not. And so then I went into graduate school and got a master's and eventually a PhD in genetics. And all the while I was looking for evidence relating to the theory. And I was always coming up empty for years. I could not find the evidence, and it made me hesitate to publish the information. And it wasn't until more recently, well, there was a lot of publicity back around 2013 about this theory. It got widespread attention. It was on radio and newspapers, and then the interest kind of died out. I think that was relating to the fact that I didn't have any really solid genetic evidence that showed our genome was consistent with the theory. And
And
so at that time,
genomic
I started
analysis
looking.
tools back in 2013 were still fairly crude compared to what we have today. Like, there's been a lot of progress in bioinformatic techniques
Oh,
and
yeah. Well, I mean,
statistical analysis.
something I didn't mention is the part of my genetic studies I went into, like creating bioinformatics software. I published a paper back, I guess it was about 2003, in bioinformatics, where I had created a data miner to find retrotransposons, and it's a new method of finding them that search for the structure that's characteristic of retrotransposons. And so I'm not really that interested in programming or in creating such tools, but after 2013, I saw that people were really demanding genetic evidence. And so I thought, well, if there's something there, you need some method of finding it that will find it, even if you don't know what you're looking for. Because that was my big problem. I didn't know what I was looking for. I didn't know whether it was, say, something related to amylase genes or
And there's issues too, like
oligochromatins. I
it's
didn't know
not
what genes I was looking for. I had no idea and no way to find out what part of the genome I should be looking at. And so
And can I clarify too, people who don't understand this field might think, oh, you'll just find like a whole gene from a pig in humans. And the problem
well, I mean, that's
is.
kind of a simplistic way of thinking about it is, that they'll say, well, this gene is present in humans and pigs and not in chimpanzees and bonobos. And that's the kind of smoking gun that they're looking for, that they're, but
And that might work if the hybridization happened like one or two generations ago, but if it was potentially millions of years ago,
yeah, then you
but.
would have all sorts of recombination going on since then, and things would become much more obscure. But the idea that I came upon was, what if you took a huge number of randomly selected pig sequences out of the pig genome and took each of those and searched for a match, both in a bonobo and in a human, and then look to see how many matches you got in humans versus in chimpanzees. And so, I mean, I don't want to go into all the details of the software,
But these were fairly
but
short sequences that should have had a chance of surviving recombination of scrambling
well,
all bits of genes from different
it's a
individuals.
statistical thing. If there are traces of pig in the human genome, you would expect to get a higher match rate if you're, like, say, in the case of this program, I set it to, like, you require at least 35 out of 40 nucleotides to match in a sequence of 40 nucleotides long, a 40-mer. And I took 813,000, I believe it was, randomly selected 40-mers and required for a hit for 35 of the nucleotides out of 40 to match if it was going to be a hit, and took each of those 40-mers and searched the entire human autosomal, well, not autosomal, the entire euchromatic genome and the bonobo euchromatic genome with each of those 813,000 40-mers. And what I found was that the hit rate was 1.3% higher in humans. And then if you actually parse it and you count the number of pig matching nucleotides in humans from those 813,000 40 mark queries, and then you count the number of pig matching nucleotides from them in bonobos, the total number of pig matching nucleotides is 1.3% higher in humans. And what's remarkable about that is that previously published studies had said that humans differ from bonobos at 1.3% of their nucleotide positions. So that meant that all of the, essentially all, I mean, there may be like small numbers of nucleotides that don't fall into this heading, but all the ones that distinguish us from bonobo match pig. So that was the big finding from that study. And so I've published that now, and so it's available on bioRxiv and also on ResearchGate. And that's a preprint. I recently just submitted the paper to the journal eLife, and they chose not to have it reviewed because they didn't explain themselves in detail, but they said that, well, this is too specialized for us. And so now I'm looking at other journals where I will submit it again. Also, I've got some more data that I'm adding into it because I recently got hold of a complete bonobo Y. I had to substitute a chimpanzee Y in the previous study. So I ran the bonobo Y with the same data set and got pretty much the same results as I did with an unassembled bonobo Y, but add that into the paper.
For
But
context too,
anyway,
for quickly for context, it's worth pointing out that genetic evidence that Neanderthals and Denisovans interbred with modern humans, what is that, like 30,000 years ago, I think it happened, has only recently been established. And that's when they had reference genomes of Neanderthals and Denisovans to put into the analysis. So it was a much more recent cross, and they had much more clearly defined data sets to compare. And that only became accepted. And I think if you'd gone back 10 years and told people, oh, Neanderthals and modern humans interbred, you probably would have gotten a lot of laughs as well. Like people wouldn't have been convinced. So it's interesting how quickly that field of analyzing DNA is changing.
yeah, but the thing that's odd is that when it comes to hybridization, I think it's odd, Shane, that no matter how many cases of hybridization you document that way, people continue to think of non-hybridization and gradual divergence as the default scenario. They think of that as everything that you don't demonstrate as not having occurred that way, they assume that it did not occur that way. They assume that there's gradual divergence, no hybridization. It's each particular case has to be demonstrated, otherwise people stick with that default notion. And so that to me, that's another thing that's very unscientific about the Darwinian outlook. It seems to be really non-scientific because we all the cases where we actually see origins occurring and we know what happened, virtually all of them have hybridization as the trigger. Whereas in all the general descriptions of what happens with evolution, it's described as these diverging lineages that are not interbreeding with each other. And so that's leaving actual observation out of the picture. That theory should be adjusted to bring it into line with observation. Not we shouldn't just ignore observations to bring our idea of the world into alignment with a theory. Theories have to be malleable. They have to be. It has to. They have to bow to observe facts.
Well,
And I see
it's like
that being the case with divergence.
yeah, and it This is why I got so excited when I learned about this theory. It feels like a paradigm shift that is building up to that point where the culture flips from instinctively denying something to instinctively embracing it. And it might take another, decade or two for people to get around to catching up.
Well, it
Or they
depends on the
could.
person. It depends on the person, I guess. I mean, there are a lot of people that I've talked to about this, and it's already flipped over in their mind. I mean, they look in, I mean, one thing I've encountered a lot is they, you say they look in the mirror and they can no longer look in the mirror without seeing pig features. And so for them, it's flipped. But then for others, it may never flip. I mean, you look at all the people that still believe in a flat earth. There's all sorts of evidence against that, but they're still believing that. So I guess I don't expect everything to change for everyone, but I do think that this presents enough evidence that many people will find it convincing and be convinced to at least some degree. So I guess whether, as you say, it'll be a paradigm shift, I guess it will be in that sense to the extent that it's accepted, but there will always be many people that don't accept that, I imagine, too, I
Now,
guess.
one really interesting consequence of this hybridization revolves around how humans managed to become so much more intelligent than chimpanzees. Do you want to dig into that a little bit more?
Well, I think the theory that I present in the where I write it all up is that, well, I was a undergraduate in mathematics, and one of the things that was often talked about in calculus class is that the surface area of a geometric solid goes increases with the square of the radius or the diameter of the solid as the solid gets bigger, whereas the volume increases with the cube. So if you're talking about heat transfer problems, as something of the same shape increases in size, its surface area is smaller in proportion to its volume. The ratio goes down and down as it gets bigger. And so the amount of heat that, say, a brain is producing by its metabolism is directly proportional to the volume of the brain. Whereas, as the surface area, as the size of the brain goes up, the surface area does not increase as fast as the volume or the amount of heat that's being produced. So there's less and less opportunity or ability for a passive cooling to be going on. You follow what I'm saying?
Well, a good intuitive example of this is you can take two people, and if you squish them up against each other, they can keep each other warmer because part of their surface area now isn't exposed to the outside anymore.
Yeah,
So
or
when you
other.
build up a mass like that, surface area gets taken away and the cooling happens through the surface.
Right, that's true. And another common example is small cars. Like, say, I'm not sure what the modern example would be, but like the Volkswagen Bug had a air-cooled engine because it was a small car. But once you get, to a large car, like say a Cadillac, you can't have an air cooling system. You have to have a water cooling system. It's that there's no way to dissipate the heat out of that deep, large engine without bringing it out by circulating water.
Yeah, you need
And
active cooling. You need more active cooling as
we
systems
have
get
to be
bigger.
like the Volkswagen, the small engine, just passive radiation of the heat from the deep engine is effective. Whereas if it's a much larger engine, it's no longer effective. And so the same thing is that if you look at a primate brain, as it gets larger, there's going to be a limit to the size of the brain if it's going to be strictly passive cooling, no circulation to the surface. And so it limits the amount of metabolic activity that can be going on in the brain. It limits the amount of blood flow. And the thing is, in looking at the anatomy of pigs, I came to realize that they have a circulatory system all over their bodies that is very effective in taking blood that's deep in their system to the surface for cooling purposes. They have muscles, but they have, excuse me, vessels that lead from their muscles directly out to the surface of the skin. And they have veins in their skull that pass out through, they're called emissary foramina, little holes in the skull that take blood out from the brain to the surface to keep the brain cool, or at least it can serve that function. It's not necessarily that it's for that purpose, but it serves that purpose. Who knows why it's actually there? But
So
that's
if you gave a chimp
excuse me.
if you gave a chimpanzee a human-sized brain, it would basically cook in the skull because
Essentially, because
chimpanzees
they have,
can't
like,
sweat.
you look at their, if you look at their skull, they don't have emissary foramina, and they don't have vessels that pass out through those foramina from the brain to essentially carry water, which is blood is mostly water, to the surface for cooling. And pigs do, and humans do. And so, what I proposed as explanation for the fact that humans have larger brains than either is that they have essentially inherited the large brain tendency of bonobos in chimpanzees, simians. And on the other side, they've inherited this circulatory system that's effective in dissipating heat. So it allows for higher levels of metabolism and better brain nourishment through large amounts of circulation and a more active, larger brain by combining those two characteristics. I didn't mention, we also have in our upper the pharynx and the nose, those regions, there are vessels that connect from the brain into those regions too, to these structures that are called blood plexuses that are not present. Those, if you looking through the anatomical information about chimpanzees, they found that they didn't have those plexuses in their pharynx and nasal cavities. So those are additional regions where heat dissipation can occur. The scalp and those regions in the nose and the throat allow for cooling in us, but not in them. So, and then a lot of, I think, a secondary reason or perceived as a greater intelligence in humans is the presence of vocal cords allows us to develop language very effectively. And they've done a lot of studies where deaf children never taught to speak. They have deficits, mental deficits that are fairly severe if they are never taught to speak. And so the language itself feeds into improvement in intelligence, of intelligence too. And of course, language is going to be hard to develop if you don't have vocal cords.
I like to think of individual humans as like computer terminals, and there's a limit to how interesting and intelligent they can be until you connect them all together with the internet, and suddenly anything that's created or discovered on one of them can be spread to all of the others, and you get this kind of duplication and combination of ideas in a way that was never possible before. And I mean, it's not that different to the implications for wide hybridization, that there's only so much evolution that can happen in one isolated population experiencing whatever selective pressures they're under. But if you can occasionally link together different populations, different species that have come up with different solutions, when you put those solutions together, you can get unexpected synergies, like
Synergy
yours.
is the word, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
And well, it makes me think, like, why didn't pigs evolve large, intelligent brains if they have this cooling system already? But presumably the chimp c contributed other factors to the combination.
it may be that they did well enough with the brain that they had. That's one thing about this whole outlook of hybridization being important in evolution versus divergence and isolation. If you have new organisms coming into being via hybridization, all you need to have is they need to be good enough to survive. They don't have to be perfect. There's sort of an idea of a constant perfecting that's going on with divergence theory, where all the time, supposedly, there are individuals that are being eliminated because they're less adapted than others. But with the hybridization outlook, if you have a new type of organism come into being and it's doing well enough to leave a few more offspring in the next generation than it did in the present one, than that were present in the present one, then the population will increase and it'll keep increasing until it bumps up against carrying capacity and then it will level off. But it doesn't make any difference, say, if pigs are increasing because of all their characteristics they have, they'll just keep on going up till they get to carrying capacity, and there's no strong selection for individual traits under that viewpoint. You can even have negative traits, such as I have like gout. What's the advantage of gout? There are many people that have gout, and it's widespread in the population. It has been for centuries. Why would that be the case? Why haven't we all been eliminated? It's just because I think that there is an overall advantage to being a human being that allows human beings to produce a sufficient number of offspring for the next generation, but any perfection process is incomplete.
A related thing on cooling the very active brain in humans, is it possible that having long hair only on our heads and a bit more in males when they grow beards might be related to the heat balance of the brain that's so unusual in humans?
Well, it's possible. I can't really say whether it's the case or not. I can say that if you look at pigs worldwide, there are various varieties that show a wide variety of hair distribution patterns. Like I think I mentioned earlier, there are ones in Southeast Asia that have big bushy beards, and they're types of pigs that have hair atop their head and also running down their backs and shoulders. It's hard to say exactly, though, whether that is functionally connected with brain cooling. I don't know. I can only say I just don't know. It's an interesting correspondence there, but whether it actually is contributory to whether it actually contributes to cooling the brain, I think there is some data, some fact. There are some facts that I'm aware of. I believe I've. Isn't it the case that people that are bald are more subject to sunstroke? Isn't that the case?
I think that might be true.
Well, in that case, the hair on the head would be contributing to brain cooling. A stroke is a result of an overheated brain.
Now,
But
there's another really interesting similarity between pigs and humans that's lacking in other primates, and that's the production of emotional tears. And it's another one of these really weird things that nobody quite knew how to explain, like why did it suddenly appear in humans? But there's been a recent discovery that human females, when they cry, they emit pheromones which seem to influence adult male behavior, like hormone levels in men drop when they smell the tears of sad women. And it's a simple testable hypothesis that they could apply similar analysis to the tears that pigs shed when they are sad, and see if there's a similar function. We've just got to figure out how to make the pigs cry on command.
well, I mean, there is definite evidence of pigs crying when they suffer or when they lose someone or another animal that they're attached to. They do shed tears, or, and as you say, chimpanzees don't do that. But certainly is some a line of research that could be explored. Like that's one thing it's I think is kind of great about this theory is it provides no end of things that you can investigate and understand, better understand and document as well. And so yeah, you could gather tears. That's one experiment. That's one of many experiments is that you could take pig tears and analyze them in that same way and see whether they have similar characteristics or perhaps even the same pheromone as do human tears under the same conditions. So
The mind boggles.
I invite some enterprising scientists to immediately carry out that experiment. I can't do it myself, but I mean, that's one reason why I've done the sort of stuff that I do is because I have not been very well funded at all. And I can always go to the library. I can always collect information. I can always write the stuff down, but it's not so easy to like carry out a lot of biological experiments because they cost a lot of money to do. You have to have all sorts of specialized equipment and you have to have personnel and you have to have animals that you're keeping and rapidly becomes extremely expensive. But there are various people that are out there that communicate with me that are investigating various aspects of this. So I think that that's one thing I do like about this is that it does provide many avenues for testing it out. It's not always the, I mean, I find a lot of the times the alternative theory, divergence theory, is kind of just patting itself on the back and not really finding out anything experimentally. Not too much that it's finding out. It's just assuming. I mean, as far as it finds things out, but it doesn't find things out that test its validity. You need alternative hypotheses to compare. You need an alternative theory to compare before you can evaluate whether divergence theory is a better theory than your alternative theory you're comparing it with. And this provides an alternative to that theory. And so at least provides a potential avenue for improving our understanding of how humans came into being. And I think it also offers, I mean, as you explore hybridization and its role in evolution more generally, it gives you an opportunity of perhaps improving our understanding of how all the different organisms on Earth came into being, not just humans. Once
Well, there's
you
plenty of other mystery appearances of highly developed groups of organisms in the fossil record. I
there's
think I
no
brought up
end.
bats as an issue. I mean, this could be a phenomenon that's happened not just to humans, but to other groups that have popped into existence.
Yeah, I used to think of it long ago. I used to think of it as that humans were this very unusual kind of distant hybrid. But since compiling this book on distant hybrids, Telanothians, I've come to think that humans are really not that weird or that distant in their origins, that there are a lot of such organisms that are out there. And in fact, I mean, if you're talking about just close crosses that can be produced, there are, mathematically, there are just a reduced number of possibilities. Whereas if you're talking about crossing an organism with, say, one animal with virtually any other kind of animal, then the possibilities for combinations are vast. And so, even if you have, as we discussed earlier, like a lot of people have the idea that if something is more distinct, if it looks very different, it's less likely that that a hybrid cross will be successful. Even if that were the case, there's so many different combinations out there that some of them may well work.
It's a little
And
bit
you
like the
could
Drake
just then try
equation.
them.
It's a bit like the Drake equation. Like, there are so many planets in just our galaxy, let alone other galaxies beyond that, that even if it's extremely unlikely for any of them to have life on it, there's probably going to be some.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is, or at least there is a much larger number of, if you think of it statistically, much larger number of trials. So if you have, a chance of 1 in 1 million, but you're trying 10 million different combinations, then you're probably going to find something. It's that sort of idea. So I think the, you talked about the broader notion of hybridization and evolution in general. There are probably quite a few organisms out there that have origins in crosses that were as far distant as equally as distant as what I'm proposing here for humans. That's probably the case, I would say. Just, that'd be my opinion. I don't, to work each one of these cases out. That's one of the disadvantages of this thing, is you have to work out each case individually. You just because you say fine that humans are probably composites of this nature doesn't mean that the next thing you're looking at is, you have to look at that new case and decide what is the case there. And so it's, but then again, that's like what I was saying, it provides no end of things to investigate. It's like a scientist bonanza. It's like, from the standpoint of somebody that wants to produce a lot of papers, they could produce a lifetime of papers just looking into various aspects of this, and it would be endless. You could fill a lifetime, many lifetimes, just investigating various lines of research that come out of this idea.
Now, we should probably wrap it up there, but I am very hopeful that I can lure you back another time to possibly talk some more about the implications and applications of this theory, which I think is only just starting to be brought to the forefront of people's minds when they hear this possibility as a mechanism in biology in the past. The obvious thing is to think about what could be done in the future with it. So, yeah, fingers crossed, I can get you back one day. I
Yeah,
will put
sure. We can be good again soon. Yeah.
and I'll put all of your links in the show notes as before, and I'd highly encourage people who are curious or skeptical or enthusiastic about this theory and this concept, go and read Gene's work and weigh it up for yourself, because there's a lot there to chew on.
Yeah, it's just, I've tried to twist theory to fit the facts. That's basically what I've been doing now for many years.
Oh, I'm very grateful.
That's my activity.
I'm very grateful for the journey that you've taken in life,
Well,
that you.
I appreciate your interest. I'm glad to be here and talk to you.
Okay, well, we'll wrap it up there, because yeah, I could easily go for another hour talking about these topics, but we'll have to
Well,
find some balance there and save some ideas for next time. So, Eugene McCarthy, thank you very much for taking the time to take us through this amazing theory.
okay, Shane. Well, till next time.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me. Or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.